Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dr. Helen Caldicott, anti-nuclear activist and founder of the Nobel Prize-winning group Physicians for Social Responsibility, who examines the danger she sees in the Bush administration's nuclear weapons policy. Jerome Pawn of the National Lawyers Guild, who challenges new powers that Attorney General John Ashcroft has given the FBI to spy on Americans engaged in constitutionally protected religious, civic, and political activities. And John Koifman with the National Resources Defense Council, who discusses President Bush's decision to ignore his administration's EPA report, acknowledging the dangers of global warming. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
As student demonstrations against the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories heated up this spring across the U.S., many confrontations took place between students of all political stripes battling over the ongoing Middle East crisis. According to The Nation magazine, Palestinian solidarity activists have started divestment campaigns on many big campuses. The targets are multinational companies like General Electric, America Online, and Nokia, who have major investments in Israel. There is also a petition at Harvard and MIT calling for campus divestment from Israel until the country complies with major United Nations resolutions and the Geneva Convention. But the divestment strategy is not an easy sell. There are counter campaigns run by pro-Israeli campus groups. However, the biggest obstacle is that harsh critiques of Israel are often labeled as anti-Semitic. A recent ugly incident occurred at San Francisco State University between pro-Israeli and pro-Palestinian groups. An email by the head of the university's Jewish Studies program said some protesters were yelling slurs at Jewish students. While the campus movements adopting the Palestinian cause are not anti-Semitic, The Nation magazine observes that students fighting the illegal Israeli occupation must remain compassionate in their message and speak in the language of universal human dignity, justice, and rights that ordinary Americans can understand. The news magazine In These Times reports that authorities in northwest Mexico are cracking down on migrant housing activists. Over the last year, in the state of Baja, the government of Mexico has arrested two leading farm labor organizers. The migrants work seasonally in the fields and travel from indigenous villages in the state of Oaxaca. Labor activists say that the government in Baja is biased against indigenous farm workers and are now engaged in a systematic effort to jail key leaders. In addition, activists say the state government has removed protections for land occupations that date back to the 1920s. In January 2002, Mexican President Vicente Fox ended the policy of redistributing vacant land to the poor. Meanwhile, wages for farm workers remain extremely low. A typical worker only earns 80 pesos, the equivalent of $8 a day in the fields. But it now costs half a day's wages to buy a kilo of meat. So most migrants and their families only eat meat once a month. Today, most migrants still live in labor camps and return to Oaxaca when the harvest is over. But authorities are actively working to prevent these workers from settling in northern Mexico. Rufino Dominguez of the Oaxaca Indigenous Binational Front stated, "Fighting for a decent wage and the rights of migrant workers is not a crime in Mexico, but they are trying to make it one." According to the news magazine Extra, the publication of the media watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, cruelty to animals in rodeos is well hidden. The tail tweaking or electric shocks the animals endure prior to being released from the stalls are not seen by the public. The straps placed in the delicate part of a bull or horse's belly are cinched so tight the animal bucks violently to try to free itself of the discomfort. Calves and steers yanked off their feet by lassoing cowboys suffer considerable pain or even broken bones. Sometimes the neck of a large-bodied steer will be jerked around by 180 degrees. ESPN is the cable network which regularly airs what some consider the sport of rodeo. ESPN, however, failed to air the 14-year-old bucking bronco Great Plains performing recently before a capacity crowd of several thousand that was carried out of the arena on a stretcher with a broken back before being shot an hour later. ESPN doesn't air this dark side of the rodeo industry, Fair says, because its broadcast is controlled by the PRCA, Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association, which has a vested interest in promoting rodeos at the expense of animal welfare. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Nigel Reese. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Despite the end of the Cold War a decade ago, the danger of nuclear war and the human catastrophe such a conflict could inflict on the planet has not diminished. In recent months, India and Pakistan have both threatened to use their nuclear arsenals in any future conflict over the disputed territory of Kashmir. The Bush administration, in its drive for military superiority, has abandoned arms control treaties and embarked on deployment of a controversial missile defense system, proposed the development of new battlefield nuclear weapons, and threatened to use nukes against non-nuclear states that may possess biological or chemical weapons. The specter of terrorist groups acquiring and using nuclear weapons has caused great public anxiety, with concerns fueled by the recent arrest of a suspect alleged to be planning to explode a radioactive bomb. These new threats, combined with the September 11th attacks on New York and Washington, have provided the White House with renewed public support for more aggressive war plans and increased military spending. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dr. Helen Caldicott, a leading anti-nuclear activist for 30 years and founder of the Nobel Prize-winning group Physicians for Social Responsibility. Dr. Caldicott, whose newest book is titled The New Nuclear Danger, George W. Bush's Military-Industrial Complex, examines the peril she sees in the Bush administration's nuclear weapons policy.
Well, it's clear that no Star Wars system would have obviated the September 11th attacks at all and will not obviate any nuclear attack upon America. I mean, a terrorist can get in. Well, one was arrested apparently in the Chicago airport with plans to build a dirty radioactive bomb. You could get a nuclear weapon into Manhattan Harbor in a container, in a ship, or on a U-Haul trailer, or whatever you want. And also a terrorist can attack any of the 103 nuclear power plants in America. September 11th was used cleverly by this administration because of the nervousness and fear of the Congress and the American people in order to ram through their Star Wars projects and all their favorite nuclear weapons projects and write a new nuclear posture review. They are already building and constructing new nuclear weapons as we speak, although the Cold War is over. They're violating most of the nuclear arms control treaties, which took years of consistent, diligent work to produce. The ABM treaty, Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, the cornerstone of all arms control treaties, is to be violated on June the 13th, the day after the 20th anniversary of the rally in which we got 1 million people in Central Park to oppose Reagan's aggressive nuclear war policies and the Star Wars policies. And they're about to violate the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty and start testing nuclear weapons again. We're in a very, very serious situation. And what worries me the most, I think, is that most American people don't really know what's going on because, apart from you and a few other areas of the media, this is not being covered at all.
What is the biggest danger confronting the world now in terms of nuclear weapons? And certainly on the front pages of our papers over the last several months, you have the specter of a catastrophic nuclear conflict between the nations of India and Pakistan. Maybe you could put that in the context of other nuclear weapons issues that could bring us horrendous conflicts in the future.
If India and Pakistan start blowing up hydrogen bombs, the early warning systems in the satellites, the infrared detectors, will pick up those explosions and could easily get confused and think their missiles being launched from Russia or vice versa, which could trigger a nuclear war between Russia and America. Likewise, if in the Middle East, when America goes into Iraq, and I say when because that seems to be the case, and Richard Perle in the Pentagon is talking about using nuclear weapons in Iraq, that could make the Russians very nervous and trigger, by accident, not by design, the launch of their 2,500 hydrogen bombs, and of course they're all targeted on the US. Or when America goes into Iraq and they get very nervous and they start sending Scud missiles towards Israel. Israel, the third largest nuclear power in the world, with about 300 hydrogen bombs, has intimated it will respond with nuclear weapons, and then you've got the same situation. In other words, any hotspot in the world where a nuclear weapon could be used could be the trigger or the fuse which could be lit to ignite the exchange of nuclear weapons between Russia and America and consequently nuclear winter. So in a way, I would say that we're in a more dangerous situation by far than we were during the Reagan era.
In this climate, do you see any stirrings of a new peace movement that will question, if not confront and resist, these new nuclear policies?
I do. You know, I was in America 6 weeks ago for a month on a book tour. I'm back now. And I was a bit scared to come speaking about the issues that are outlined in my book. I thought I might be lynched or I might end up in Guantanamo Bay because I have a green card, but I'm an alien. However, the opposite occurred. I spoke to hundreds of thousands of people through the media, talkback shows and audiences face-to-face. Not one person disagreed with what I was saying. People rather expressed very profound concerns about what is happening, deep concerns. They were relieved that someone was openly saying what they felt. And people were even calling from the audience, how do we get rid of Bush? So my feeling quite strongly was that the polls are inaccurate and that there's a rising concern which hasn't expressed itself yet in the mobilization of millions of people, but that I feel that's about to occur. I've got three grandchildren. I'm a pediatrician. I'm so worried about the future for these children. And as Star Wars proceeds and the threat to use nuclear weapons proceeds, I can't see that they have a future at all unless we, particularly the people of the United States, stand up and say, look, you're not to do this anymore. You've got to produce abolition of nuclear weapons. And to that end, I'm setting up an institute called the Nuclear Policy Research Institute in order to take on the Heritage Foundation and Rumsfeld and Cheney in the media to teach the American people what's actually going on. And I think in 5 years, if the American people get going again, as they did in the 80s, that we actually can produce abolition of nuclear weapons and the end of the nuclear age and close down 103 nuclear power plants in America that are all targets for terrorists now.
That was Dr. Helen Caldicott, author of The New Nuclear Danger, George W. Bush's Military-Industrial Complex, published by New Press. Contact Dr. Caldicott's Nuclear Policy Research Institute at area code 213-225-5941 or visit their website at www.nuclearpolicy.org. Not long after a cascade of revelations embarrassed the White House, the FBI, and CIA about information they had received about threats from the Al-Qaeda network prior to the September 11th attacks, Attorney General John Ashcroft granted the FBI new powers to spy on Americans engaged in constitutionally protected religious, civic, and political activities. The guidelines set forth by the Bush administration remove constraints placed on the intelligence agencies by Congress to prevent abuses that were documented from the 1960s through the 1980s. Among the targets of J. Edgar Hoover's COINTELPRO, or counterintelligence program of that era, were civil rights, church, and peace groups active in the struggle for desegregation and against the war in Vietnam. Congressional hearings in the 1970s revealed that these groups were infiltrated, disrupted, and harassed by the FBI. The movement's leaders, such as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., were closely monitored by federal agencies, which issued death threats and subjected them to blackmail. Defended as essential in the U.S. war against terrorism, the FBI has once again been unleashed to snoop on the lawful activity of Americans by means of electronic surveillance and infiltration, even if there is no evidence indicating prior or future criminal activity. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Attorney Jerome Pawn, treasurer of the National Lawyers Guild, who challenges the notion that we must sacrifice our civil liberties for enhanced security.
There's nothing new about this stuff. It's just that it's all being done now out in the open. The FBI, and to a lesser extent, I suppose, the CIA, in the 60s and 70s engaged in this kind of behavior regularly. It was part of a program that was then called COINTELPRO. That program went on for many years and involved FBI agents attending meetings of various organizations, infiltrating those organizations, ultimately even including escalating the activity in those organizations to the point where the agents became agent provocateurs, people who encouraged the organizations that may not have been inclined to engage in illegal activity, although they were engaged in civil disobedience or other forms of protected protest, to engage in acts that may have been illegal. All the meanwhile, providing that information to the FBI and the government so that people could be arrested when they engaged in those acts. All of that is now, once again, legal. That's not to say that John Ashcroft or anybody else is openly telling agents or the FBI or anybody else to engage in this activity. But the problem is that you open floodgates when you sanction this kind of behavior.
There are many in the Bush administration that say it's necessary to trade our freedom and civil liberties for security in a time of terrorism and terrorist attacks on the continental United States. How do you respond to that?
I'm glad you asked that question, because I don't want to tell you what I think about that. I'm going to tell you what somebody eminently more qualified and I think much wiser than I had to say about that. Benjamin Franklin said that he who would sacrifice liberty for the sake of security deserves neither. I think that's exactly right. I think that the sacrifice of liberty that they talk about and that has been countenanced and foisted upon by the USA Patriot Act and foisted upon the citizens and residents of the United States is nothing more than an illusion of security. It is not security. Thousands of Arab American men were arrested or detained. They weren't technically arrested because they were never actually arraigned, but they were picked up, transported someplace, and locked up and held. Some are still being held. We don't know who they are. When this happened in Chile and in other Latin American countries, the term disappeared became used. These were people who became disappeared. Well, that's what we've done. We've permitted these people to be disappeared. Of all the thousands of people that they have disappeared, many of whom have reappeared now, none of them, to my knowledge, has been charged with any criminal act related to national security. So I don't believe that any of this stuff that has been passed in the USA Patriot Act and the fallout since demonstrates that they needed these draconian invasions of civil liberties in order to increase our security. I mean, the truth of the matter is, as revelations of recent weeks have demonstrated, that they didn't use, the FBI and the CIA didn't apparently use the tools that they already had in place, that they could have used, that at least it can be argued, might have, in one way or another, disrupted the attacks on 9/11. Because they weren't even talking to each other. And to the extent they were talking to each other, they weren't listening to each other.
Is there any movement that you can detect in Congress or among civil society in general to oppose these new regulations allowing the FBI to spy domestically as they did during the 60s and 70s?
The worst thing that we can do is sit back and do nothing. If we allow them, the government, to get away with this kind of tyrannical behavior now. Right now, they're going after those people who they've identified one way or another as terrorists. But many of the provisions of the USA Patriot Act are not limited to national security, despite the fact that many people think that this act is going to sunset in 2005. Many of its provisions do not sunset. They remain law until they are either held unconstitutional by a court or repealed by Congress. And as more abuses, and there will be more abuses, by the FBI and the CIA and others in the intelligence community, as those become apparent, people need to be pressing their congresspeople to rein this stuff in, because otherwise we're going to be living with this for, I think, a long time.
That was Jerome Pawn, treasurer of the National Lawyers Guild. Contact the Guild by calling area code 212-627-2656 or visit their website at www.nlg.org. In an environmental about-face, the Bush administration last week released a report acknowledging the reality of global climate change. The new report, issued quietly by the Environmental Protection Agency, points to human activity as the culprit in the form of emissions from oil refineries, power plants, and motor vehicles, and contradicts earlier White House pronouncements that there was not enough evidence to link industrial emissions to global warming. In response to the report, the Bush administration continues to advocate voluntary industry guidelines to reduce those emissions. In the EPA findings, which were submitted to the United Nations, the administration forecasts that total U.S. greenhouse gas emissions will increase an astonishing 43% between 2000 and 2020. The U.S. is by far the largest producer of greenhouse gases in the world. But even in the face of this report by his own administration, Mr. Bush has refused to reconsider his withdrawal from the Kyoto Protocol, a UN-backed treaty to cut emissions of greenhouse gases such as carbon dioxide. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with John Koifman, a spokesperson with the National Resources Defense Council, about the EPA's report, the current status of the Kyoto Protocol, and actions the U.S. can take to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
The report is remarkable in that it's the first time that the Bush administration has formally acknowledged that global warming is going to have a significant impact on the United States, on our economy, on public health, on the environment. And they've also acknowledged that the cause of the problem is in large part the carbon dioxide pollution that comes from our automobiles and from power plants.
So this is something that's a reversal, is it not? Bush was earlier saying that more study needed to be done, that they couldn't make these conclusions, and therefore it had no particular plan of action to deal with this issue, this problem?
Well, really what's happened here is that the administration has finally gotten in step with the mainstream of scientific opinion, the story that experts have been telling us for a decade or more. The trouble now is that they're stuck with a weak set of voluntary global warming measures on the policy side that really don't do much to solve the problem. Shortly after they took office, the Bush administration announced that the United States was going to withdraw from the Kyoto Global Warming Treaty. This is an accord signed in 1997 under the Clinton administration in Kyoto, Japan. And they have subsequently announced that they oppose carbon dioxide limits on U.S. power plants. The administration has opposed controlling carbon dioxide emissions from automobiles by making them more efficient and cleaner. And they have been fighting this issue tooth and nail. So the trouble is now what happens next given this report. This is going to be a tough genie for them to put back into the bottle. The irony of this story, of course, is that the news hit in the same week that 15 countries of the European Union and the government of Japan voted to ratify the Kyoto Climate Treaty, and they're going to go ahead with it. We're now within just a couple of more countries coming on board to the deal. It'll be Russia and Poland, most likely by the end of this year, to put that treaty into effect. We don't expect that the United States, under the current administration, is going to join the deal. But there's a tremendous amount that we can do here domestically, at home, to begin solving the problem. The first step is going to be to clean up global warming emissions from our power plants. Next week, the Senate is holding hearings on a bill called the Clean Power Act, sponsored by Senator Jeffords of Vermont. That bill has got tough control measures on traditional pollutants, sulfur and nitrogen and mercury that cause smog and other kinds of problems, but it also controls carbon dioxide emissions for the first time. And that's something the White House opposes. The second big step is going to be to get at cleaning up automobile emissions. And at the federal level, that may take some time. The state of California, the legislature there, is currently considering a bill that will set new tailpipe emission standards for carbon dioxide. It's cleared both the House, the Assembly, and the Senate in California, and is now due for a revote in the Assembly to reconcile the two bills. Governor Davis said last week that he wants to see the bill on his desk.
Now, with this newest report, though, do you get any sense of any kind of push from below where people who are in the Republican Party or other maybe elected officials within the Republican Party who would say, you know, environmentalism hasn't historically been a Democratic issue. It's been a bipartisan issue. Do you think that this might move the country toward a more bipartisan agreement that more needs to be done?
The Republican Party has got a lot of famous conservationists to its name, going all the way back, of course, to Teddy Roosevelt, who gave us our national park system and was a tremendous outdoorsman. Senator John McCain of Arizona, the Republican, has been a strong supporter of action on global warming, was a strong supporter of getting tougher fuel economy standards on cars and light trucks in this country, and fought a tough battle on the Senate earlier this year, one that was defeated when the auto industry spent millions of dollars on an ad campaign to block the measure. So, you know, we do think that there's hope out there in the Republican Party. It's a people issue. It's an issue that hits us where we live. It hits our environment, but it also hits our economy. You've got an enormous amount of infrastructure in low-lying coastal areas that is going to have to be addressed. Farmers in this country are going to face more erratic weather patterns, both more drought and more severe weather. All of these things come with a price tag. All of them are going to be something that somebody has to foot the bill for. We have the technology to begin solving this problem. This is something we know how to do. But the trick is for somebody to make the decision to go ahead and start solving the problem and to get our head out of the sand on this. We hope that the administration report this week moves this debate forward and can help America get on the right track to solving the problem.
That was National Resource Defense Council's John Koifman. Contact the council by calling area code 202-289-6868 or visit their website at www.nrdc.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Nigel Reese, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Currie.